Dame Law School while Judge Barrett was a professor. Remember what she had to say. I have only communicated with this August committee on two occasions. The first was 10 years ago when I wrote a strong letter in support of now Justice Elena Kagan, whose term as Dean of Harvard Law School overlapped with my own. The second is today introducing and endorsing Amy Coney Barrett in equally strong terms. Some might find these recommendations in juxtaposition, but I find them entirely consistent.
We're listening to Senator Lindsey Graham. The Senate Judiciary Committee is about to vote on the Supreme Court nomination of Amy Coney Barrett. This is live special coverage.
The committee will hold over S-4632, Online Consent Policy Modernization Act. I ask unanimous consent that notwithstanding the motion of October 15th, setting the vote on the Barrett nomination at 1 p.m., the committee proceed immediately to vote on the Barrett nomination. Any objection? Without objection.
And here we go.
On the motion to report the nomination of Amy Coney Barrett to be an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States, the clerk will call the roll.
Favorably to the floor.
The clerk will call the roll.
Mr. Grassley.
Aye.
Mr. Cornyn.
Aye.
Mr. Lee.
Aye.
Mr. Cruz.
Aye.
Mr. Sass.
Aye.
Mr. Hawley.
Aye.
Mr. Tillis.
Aye.
Ms. Ernst.
Aye.
Mr. Crapo.
Aye.
Mr. Kennedy.
Aye.
Mrs. Blackburn.
Aye.
Mrs. Feinstein. Mr. Leahy. Mr. Durbin. Mr. Whitehouse.
We're hearing no response on the Democratic
Klobuchar.
Side. Their chairs
Mr.
are empty.
Coons. Mr. Blumenthal. Ms. Hirono. Mr. Booker. Ms. Harris. Mr. Chairman.
Aye.
Mr. Chairman, the votes are 12 yeas, 10 no votes.
The nomination will be reported favorably to the floor with a unanimous vote. Senator Cornyn.
Mr. Chairman, I'll just take a couple of minutes. I just find this to be a surreal environment we're in, where our Democratic colleagues announced yesterday they're going to boycott one of the most important votes this committee will have.
John Cornyn,
probably
of Texas.
During our entire senatorial tenure, and that is a vote to confirm, to provide advice and consent to a nominee for the Supreme Court of the United States. But I just want to comment on the pictures that are in their chairs, like this is some sort of sporting event during COVID-19, and rather than show up and do their job, they choose to continue the theater that was part of the hearing. And of course, this is all pretextual. Their argument, as I understand it, is somehow Amy Coney Barrett will violate her oath of office, contrary to everything she has done and who she is, and somehow that the Affordable Care Act is in jeopardy. She explained, I think, with great skill, the issue before the Supreme Court. It's really one of severability, which is a very technical doctrine. It doesn't have anything to do with the merits of the Affordable Care Act. It has to do whether you can sever the unconstitutional portion from the rest of the ACA, and that it will survive. But the fact is, Democrats have already moved on from the ACA. In Senator Cruz, in my state, in the last 6 years, the premiums for an individual under the ACA have gone up, I believe, 57%. The average deductible is about $3,000. For a family of four, the deductible is $12,000, which means that, in essence, you do not have insurance coverage. You're essentially self-insured. So what Democrats have done is they realized that all of the promises that were made to the American people leading up to the passage of the ACA, they have been broken. I remember President Obama saying, if you liked your policy, you could keep your policy. If you liked your doctor, you can keep your doctor. None of that's true. They said that we would have essentially universal health insurance coverage. That's obviously not true. So ACA has failed. Our Democratic colleagues recognize that. And that's why they have, from the presidential candidates running in the primary all the way down to people running in this election on November 3rd, including in my state, have advocated a single-payer system, sometimes called Medicare for All, sometimes called the public option.
We've been listening to Senator John Cornyn of Texas as some committee proceedings continue here for a little while. Senator Cornyn, changing the subject somewhat from the Supreme Court nomination of Amy Coney Barrett to talk about the Affordable Care Act, although this is not entirely irrelevant because, if confirmed, as seems very likely, Judge Barrett would be on the U.S. Supreme Court in time for a ruling, a case that challenges the Affordable Care Act. Senator Cornyn making the rather remarkable statement there, if I understood him correctly, that everybody knows the ACA is here to stay and not going anywhere, and that the debate has moved on and that Democrats should be moving on as well. And I say remarkable because Republicans have tried so devotedly for so many years to repeal or remove or have that act overturned. Just before Senator Cornyn's statement, we heard the dramatic vote there, the committee vote for Amy Coney Barrett. The clerk called 12 yay votes and 10 abstentions. So 12 Republicans voted yes, 10 Democrats were not present. And let's begin with NPR's Kelsey Snell talking through the meaning of that. Kelsey, what happened there and how does it fit the Senate rules?
Yeah, so the Democrats announced last night that they were going to be boycotting this hearing, and they said that they were going to essentially deny Republicans the opportunity to have a quorum for this vote. They said that there is a part of the rules for the Judiciary Committee that require that there be two people from the minority party present. Now, Republicans say that the rules also say they just need a majority for things to move forward in the committee, and they relied on that portion of the rule. So there is some language and conflict in the rules, and the committee pointed to seven other occasions when the committee moved forward proceeded on a number of issues without there being a full quorum there. But this is controversial among Democrats, and they say that they don't support this process. They say the winner of the presidential election should choose the next Supreme Court justice. And they do say that they will participate in the vote on the Senate floor, which is expected to happen on Monday, but they did not want to participate in what they say was an invalid process.
Yeah, illegitimate, I believe, is the word that's been used by the Senate minority leader Chuck Schumer. Our Supreme Court legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg joins us now. She's been listening in and watching these proceedings. And Nina, what are you hearing?
Well, I have a question for Kelsey. Last night when it became clear that the Democrats were going to boycott, the Republican majority issued a statement saying they would go through with this vote today, and they cited three or four times over the course of history, or at least recent times, in which the committee has gone ahead even though the minority was not there. And what I don't know about that is whether any or all of those times involved the minority agreeing to let the majority go ahead without them being there. It may well be that they didn't agree. I simply don't know. I just know that in terms of the Supreme Court, I have never seen anything like this. They always somehow make enough of an accommodation to go through the paces, even if they're pretty mad. And this time, they're skipping the paces.
Yeah, I think that's a fair question. We don't really know the circumstances of those votes, though I will say that, you know, a part of what is happening here is that Democrats are doing a little bit of correcting in some ways for criticism that they got, that they were too friendly with Republicans and didn't do enough to block this process in the beginning. There was a particular criticism from progressive activists that the top Democrat on the committee, Dianne Feinstein, hugged the chairman, Lindsey Graham, at the end of the questioning during the main part of this hearing and complimented him on how he ran the hearing so far. And there has been intense pressure from some of those progressive activists for Dianne Feinstein to step down as the top Democrat on that committee.
And in fact, Lindsey Graham made a reference to that in his remarks today just before the vote, did he not?
He did. And, you know, there has been a fairly strong defense, particularly from some Republicans on the committee of Feinstein, saying that, you know, she is a longtime legislator with a strong background in defending things like reproductive rights and should be, you know, recognized as a legislator. I believe Chuck Grassley, who was once chairman of this committee and who is himself the second oldest person in the Senate, said that this is an ageist question because Feinstein is the oldest member of the Senate.
In fact, the only people who really defended her were the Republicans.
To some degree, there were Democrats who did speak up on her behalf, but there has been an ongoing discussion among Democrats about how to handle this question.
Let's listen to a little bit of the statement made a short time ago by Chairman Lindsey Graham just before he asked the clerk to call the roll on this vote. He, to my ear, sounded rather emotional as he made these remarks. And of course, he is a politician who has stirred some pretty intense emotions in the people who hear him as well. Let's listen to just a bit of that.
They started this, not me. If it were up to me, there'd be a 60-vote requirement in the Senate today.
That's just a little bit of Senator Graham there. Now, what he's referring to is the vote that is to come, the vote on the full on the Senate floor involving the full Senate. In years past, in Supreme Court nominations past, it would have been possible for the minority to filibuster. But Graham recalls a little bit of history as to how that has changed as part of this intensifying battle over judges. Nina, what's he referring to?
Well, at some point towards the end of the Obama administration, I think it was in 2014, Mitch McConnell was blocking virtually all of their judgeships. And they decided finally that they were going to break the filibuster rule, get rid of the filibuster for lower court judgeships. At one point, actually, they said there were three positions open on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. The Democrats went to McCain, who had brokered compromises in this area before, and said, Senator John McCain, the late Senator John McCain. And they went to McCain and they said, look, we will fill only one of these if you guys will agree to let us do that and move some of our other judgeships that have been open for a year or more. And he took the proposal to the Republican caucus, and it was quickly dispatched with a no. So the Democrats busted the filibuster for lower court judges, but they left intact the filibuster for the Supreme Court. And when Neil Gorsuch was nominated, Senator McConnell promptly extended the getting rid of the filibuster to the Supreme Court. And there were some Democrats, tended to be sort of some of the older members of the caucus, who thought that was foolish to do, at least for the Gorsuch nomination, to save it for when Justice Kennedy retired. That would have been the Kavanaugh nomination. But again, the pressure from the left of the party was such that they really had to do it, they felt anyway, right then.
Let me bring back Kelsey, because what I want to observe here, Kelsey, is that Senator Graham is offering a particular view of history, and it's reminding me, to be frank, of covering a story like the Middle East, where everyone has their own version of history. It goes back to a particular point in history, and that is the moment when they were treated unjustly, and they go forward from there. Senator Graham has this moment of 2013, 2014, when he feels Democrats made a power grab, and he says, they started this, not me. Don't Democrats have a completely different view of history in this moment that goes back to a completely different point?
Right. Democrats say that they had to make this move because Republicans were preventing them from making any progress on these lower court nominations. One thing I will say is that this has been a theme of the Senate since the moment that happened, and that there has been a conversation about the slippery slope of the filibuster in the Senate for as long as I have been covering the Senate. And I think that it is something that we are seeing now play out, not just about the filibuster, which, you know, has become a question in the presidential election, whether or not it should be eliminated entirely so that the majority party would have total control over, you know, whether or not something could potentially pass. You wouldn't have to wait to get 60 votes to get something passed. That 60-vote threshold is supposed to be kind of the cooling off moment for the Senate. It's one of the things that distinguishes the Senate from the House. It's also at play in the conversation about packing the court. These are very, very similar arguments happening between Democrats and Republicans about what happens when you take a step to change a rule that's been in place for a long time that is a defining rule for an institution.
And I guess we should mention there's a little bit of news today, if you'll forgive me, Nina, that I'm going to come right back to you. Joe Biden, the Democratic presidential candidate, has said today, just in the last little while, or we've learned that he has said in the last little while, that he would appoint a bipartisan commission of constitutional scholars to study potential reforms to the Supreme Court if he's elected as president. That is the answer he's giving to this question of whether he would support court packing, adding justices so that if there's a Democratic president and a Democratic Senate, the Democrats could get more people of their persuasion on the court. Nina, go ahead.
Well, that is sort of an exquisite punt. You know, when he said, I think it was last week, I'm no fan of court packing, mm-hmm. I think that represents what Joe Biden thinks, which is, I'm not expending every piece of political capital I've got at the beginning of my presidency, if I'm elected, in order to get two more justices added to the court. To avoid that is with a punt, and that's what he did.
In the last couple of minutes that we have, I want to back up to the actual nominee, Amy Coney Barrett, and talk about her significance. Lindsey Graham, in his remarks, gave her a kind of historic significance. He almost spoke of her as a pathfinder, almost like a civil rights pioneer, saying that that this nomination tells young conservative women there is a place at the table for you and that it is okay to be pro-life and be on the court. Kelsey, why speak of her that way?
Well, because a part of what the conversation that Republicans have been attempting to have here is both trying to make this a political argument where Democrats are going after conservatives unfairly, and also to make the argument that she is a qualified judge. And that was a large portion of what the presentation that Lindsey Graham had was that in the past, judges were chosen based on their qualifications and not about choosing a justice based on their politics or who nominated that judge, but just their judicial qualifications. Right. And that is something that Republicans wanted to focus on today.
Nina, go ahead. I'm going to give you the last word here.
I do think he was trying to have his cake and eat it, too, because he said quite accurately that she is fully qualified, and that's what ought to be. In the past, that was the criteria. At the same time, he was saying, look, we've got a pro-life judge. And that is a message he wants to send with an election less than 2 weeks away.
And he also didn't mention Merrick Garland, another point in history that's a sore point for Democrats, because that judgeship was blocked. And even Lindsey Graham said that he would not do what he's doing now in an election year.
Correct.
So we have the results here. Once again, let's just review. The Senate Judiciary Committee met briefly today. In fact, some remarks are still going on, but only the Republicans showed up in this committee. And so the vote was 12 in favor of Judge Amy Coney Barrett, a favorable recommendation to the full Senate for her nomination confirmation to the Supreme Court. 12 in favor and 10 abstentions. The Democrats stayed away. Chuck Schumer, the minority leader, arguing that this was an illegitimate process. Lindsey Graham, the Republican chairman of the Judiciary Committee, arguing that he'd never seen anyone more capable than Judge Barrett on the law, and argued that she was proudly pro-life and that that was fine, that it was okay to be a complete person and be on the bench, and also argued that she's someone who serves as a kind of example for young conservative women and what they can do and what they can be. And as Nina properly pointed out, that lays out some of the threads of debate that will continue regardless of what happens with this nomination. What we can expect, and let's just go to for about 10 seconds here to Kelsey Snell, what do we expect? What's the process from here on out?
Well, the Senate will stay in session for over the weekend. We expect a vote on her nomination in the full Senate on Monday.
Okay, coming right up on Monday, and we'll continue to bring you coverage of that right here on NPR News. Kelsey Snell, NPR congressional correspondent, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg, thanks as always to you.
Thank you.
And we're going to return to our regularly scheduled programming. I'm Steve Inskeep. This is live special coverage from NPR News.
You're listening to WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.
You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. We're returning to Morning Edition, and we'll have the latest news from NPR and WPR up next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Moments ago, Republicans on the Senate Judiciary Committee voted to send to the full Senate the nomination of Judge Amy Coney Barrett to the U.S. Supreme Court. All 12 GOP lawmakers on the panel voted to advance Barrett's nomination. Democrats boycotted the hearing to protest what they call an illegitimate process. The full Senate is expected to vote next week to confirm Barrett as the next justice on the nation's high court. She would succeed the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who died last month. The Supreme Court is upholding a lower court decision to ban curbside voting in Alabama. Gigi Duban with member station WBHM has more from Birmingham.
Alabama's Republican Secretary of State John Merrill called the practice of curbside voting fraudulent. And the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling now blocks that option for Alabama voters. The three liberal justices on the nation's high court wrote in their dissenting opinion that the court should not stand in the way of some election officials who want to help vulnerable voters cast their ballots without risking infection from the coronavirus. Curbside voting had been used to help voters with disabilities and others at risk of contracting the virus. State Attorney General Steve Marshall argued the practice presents logistical and ballot secrecy concerns. For NPR News, I'm Gigi Duban in Birmingham, Alabama.
This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Melissa Ingalls. State and city officials have been working with law enforcement to make sure polls are safe and secure on Election Day. President Donald Trump has called on supporters to monitor polls for signs of voter fraud, raising fears of voter intimidation. The Wisconsin Elections Commission is in the process of developing guidance for election officials regarding firearms at polling places. Commission spokesman Reed Magny told WPR Central Time he's encouraging clerks to work with local law enforcement so they're at the polls in case there's a problem.
Now, that said, there should not be like uniformed police stationed at polling places. That's potentially intimidating to some voters.
Magny says the commission doesn't have the authority to make any rules about firearms at polling places, but firearms that are displayed in a threatening manner at or near a polling place would be considered voter intimidation under state law. A group of colleges and universities in southeastern Wisconsin have teamed up to close the gap in graduation rates between students of color and those who are white by 2030. Rich Kramer reports.
UW-Milwaukee, UW-Parkside, Carthage College, and Milwaukee Area Technical College have joined the effort called Moonshot for Equity. Latoya White of consulting firm Education Advisory Board says they're partnering with the campuses to offer data tracking software to catch struggling students before they drop out.
What this does is breaks down those silos across campus so that advisors, tutors, faculty, even financial aid can collaborate together in a unified system.
Earlier this year, a national report showed that around 40% of black students at public colleges in Wisconsin graduated within 6 years. At the same time, the graduation rate for white students was more than 76%. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Wisconsin has recorded its highest one-day total of new coronavirus deaths. There were 48 new deaths reported Wednesday afternoon, and 43% of tests reported came back as positive. The Wisconsin Department of Health Services says there have been 1,681 deaths to date from the coronavirus pandemic, while nearly 183,000 people have tested positive. DHS confirmed 4,205 more cases of the coronavirus, and 167 more people have had to be hospitalized. This is news from WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Medicare open enrollment is now through December 7th. 2021 plans and information at medicare.gov or 1-800-MEDICARE. From Indeed, committed to helping businesses find candidates with the right skills for critical roles so managers can focus on hiring the person who is a good fit. Learn more at Indeed.com/credit. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Noelle King. Good morning. There are several COVID-19 vaccines in development, but before they are approved, they have to be safe. It's the FDA's job to ensure that. Today, an FDA advisory panel is meeting for the first time about the coronavirus vaccine. It'll be making recommendations based not on politically motivated timetables, but on data. Sydney Lupkin covers the pharmaceutical industry for NPR. Good morning, Sydney.
Good morning.
So what is the deal with this FDA panel? Who's on it? What are they going to be doing?
Well, the FDA regularly turns to committees of outside advisors for guidance. Most often, these panels are asked to evaluate specific drugs or health products, and that helps the agency to decide whether to approve these products. Today's meeting of the committee that looks at vaccines is going to be a little different.
How?
Like everything else in this pandemic, it's a bit unusual. The big difference is that the committee isn't going to be sifting through data for a specific coronavirus vaccine like it normally would. The meeting will be a broader discussion of how the agency should think about safety and effectiveness of these new kinds of vaccines, particularly safety. Dr. Paul Offit is a committee member who works at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia.
How robust safety data be? How long, for example, after the first dose or second dose should patients be followed or participants be followed for any possible safety issue?
They'll be discussing FDA's existing guidance to companies, which includes some of that information. They'll also discuss how studies should continue after the first vaccine is given the green light. What do you do for patients who got a placebo once a vaccine is widely available? Of course, the FDA usually heeds the advice of these committees, but it doesn't have to.
So since there's no vaccine to review, I would think that in ordinary times, we would not know about this meeting. It would not be news at all. It's very clear that the FDA wants to make public that this is happening. Why do they want to do that?
Well, I mean, it gives the American public a window into the process. There's been so much discussion around whether the FDA will put politics ahead of science. So it's important to see what's going on. And the FDA has questions that it wants answers to. Here's Dr. Miles Braun, a former FDA epidemiologist.
There is a level of humility that the FDA is coming to its advisors with. And I think that's a good thing. And if they find out they've missed some important things, they'll address those.
Committee members will hear presentations from scientists at the FDA, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority. The public will also have an opportunity to weigh in. Diana Zuckerman is the president of the National Center for Health Research and advocacy group slated to speak.
We've seen the guidances of what they're telling companies they're supposed to be studying. Frankly, they're not very stringent, so we are concerned about them.
She hopes the meeting will delve into making sure the clinical trials are diverse, for example. She also questions whether the study approach the FDA suggested to manufacturers is long enough to assess vaccine safety.
So then how does this meeting set up for next steps in the process of reviewing a vaccine?
This is the first of several advisory committee meetings expected through the fall and winter. The same committee will meet again to evaluate individual vaccines. Instead of full approval, however, vaccine makers will be seeking a truncated version called emergency use authorization. Here's Dr. Offit again.
The rules here are a little looser in terms of what you would demand in terms of safety or demand in terms of effectiveness of the vaccine.
Remember, these vaccines will be given to millions and millions of otherwise healthy people, so making sure they're safe is really important.
And so when do we find out more about the leading vaccines?
Pfizer and Moderna, the front runners, are expected to have their data ready as soon as November. So once they submit it to the FDA, the public meetings could happen really quickly.
Sydney Lupkin, NPR's pharmaceuticals correspondent. Thanks, Sydney.
Thank you.
In this fall's election, Republicans are trying to fend off further losses in the House. Ben Pavia reports on a Virginia district that could flip.
The little town of Fork Union, Virginia, voted for President Trump by 3 points in 2016. Since then, residents like Ron Lewis say things have gotten worse.
As you can see, there's no business in there. The only thing we have is a drugstore and a bank.
Just this spring, a half-century-old restaurant closed its doors. Now Lewis and other locals have gathered in its parking lot to hear from Democratic congressional hopeful Cameron Webb, a man Lewis believes has the background to help turn Fork Union's tides. Webb speaks from a distance. He was treating COVID-19 patients until just a few days ago.
I'm a doctor, I'm a lawyer, and I'm a professor at the University of Virginia.
And I know y'all are looking at me like I'm too young to do all that. Listen, I'm 37 years old and black don't crack. And that's the reason that it works that way. But anyway.
In 2015, Webb added a White House fellowship to his resume. When President Trump took office, Webb says his desk was moved to the hallway.
I joke they made the biggest mistake they could have because they left an extrovert in the hallway. So all I did is started walking around every day.
Webb says he was able to find common ground with Republicans. It's a strategy he's now taking to the campaign trail in a district Trump won by 11 points. Several polls now show Webb with a slight lead.
It's in play. It's more than in play.
Dave Wasserman edits the Cook Political Report, which now classifies the race as a toss-up.
Democrats landed perhaps their best candidate of the cycle anywhere in the country in Cameron Webb.
Wasserman says Webb is driving Democratic enthusiasm deep in Trump country. It's a trend he's seen across the U.S.
Places like suburban Indianapolis and St. Louis and San Antonio, Phoenix, Cincinnati, Omaha, these are all places where Republicans could lose seats.
Democrats like Webb hold a large fundraising edge in close House races. Due to retirements, Republicans are also defending almost three times as many open seats. Webb is running for one of them. It opened up after the sitting congressman, Republican Denver Riggleman, lost his party's nomination after he officiated a gay marriage.
Republicans have gone through essentially a civil war within their own party.
West Virginia, the Red Mountain, Shenandoah.
The GOP projected a unified front at a pig roast in the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains. The speakers included Bob Good, a former Liberty University athletics director who's the party's nominee to take on Webb. The self-described biblical conservative takes a dim view of Democrats.
The Democrat Party, including my opponent, frankly, is the party of death. They are the party of abortion at any time, at any reason, up to the moment of birth.
Meanwhile, Webb has touted his medical expertise during the pandemic. He's one of more than half a dozen doctors running for Congress this year. Good dismisses that background.
That's what we need, is another doctor running our government, by the way.
Another issue that's come up is racial justice. Good says Webb is a radical for supporting Black Lives Matter. But in a district where one in five people are black, voter Ron Lewis in Fork Union says Webb's background gives him an edge.
Because we've never had a black person to stand up for this particular community or this county before.
Democrats briefly held the seat in 2008 with the help of black voters. But Republicans have won every election since then. This year and this president have scrambled the old math and put some parts of Trump country back in play. For NPR News, I'm Ben Pavier in Richmond.
This is NPR News.
You're tuned to Wisconsin Public Radio, and it's 8:42 right now. Good morning. Coming up in 9 minutes, the hosts of the new NPR investigative podcast, No Compromise, will introduce us to Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, who is all but certain to win a seat in the House in November. She is rooted in a style of confrontational politics that is revolutionizing the debate about guns and is a believer in the conspiracy theory known as QAnon.
There is a whole lot of uncertainty surrounding this election, and as you know,
uncertainty is generally really bad for economic activity, and we are going to create an environment of a lot more uncertainty if there's a contested election.
I'm Kai Rizdahl from Small Businesses to Relief Bills, how election uncertainty might hit this economy. That's next time on Marketplace.
Hear Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from Lawrence University in Appleton, a national liberal arts college and conservatory, committed to an 8-to-1 student-to-professor ratio and a personalized education. Lawrence.edu.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, Kenosha Police will host Drug Take Back Day on Saturday, October 24th. This effort keeps dangerous pharmaceutical substances from the state's medicine cabinets and prevents them from going into the water supply. Visit Dose of Reality, WI.
Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's some of what's in the news this morning. The Senate Judiciary Committee has advanced Judge Amy Coney Barrett's Supreme Court nomination to the full Senate. Republicans powered past a Democratic boycott of the session today to keep confirmation of President Donald Trump's pick on track before Election Day. Democratic senators refused to show up in protest of the GOP's rush to install Trump's nominee to replace the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. The Senate has never confirmed a Supreme Court nominee so close to a presidential election. President Donald Trump and Democratic challenger Joe Biden are set to square off in their final debate tonight. There were supposed to be three debates, but the second was canceled after Trump got COVID-19 and then objected to the resulting revised format. WPR will have live coverage of that starting at 8 o'clock. And we'll have all the latest news from WPR and NPR for you in 15 minutes.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting those working towards a day when no one has to choose between paying rent, putting food on the table, and protecting their health and the health of others. RWJF.org. From the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide to address inequality in all its forms. Learn more at FordFoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Noelle King. Here's something that President Trump and Joe Biden agree on. Globalization has left some American workers behind. They do not agree on how to fix the problem. Cardiff Garcia and Stacey Vanek Smith, who host Planet Money's Indicator podcast, started wondering, when and where did globalization start?
The year is 986, and the Norse sagas tell of a Viking named Bjarni Herjolfsson, who is sailing west from Norway.
He wanted to spend the winter with his father.
That is Yale historian Valerie Hansen.
And his father, he thought, was in Iceland, so he went to Iceland.
But Bjarni's father had gone to Greenland with other Norse explorers. So Bjarni keeps sailing west until he spots a new land southwest of Greenland.
And that place is called Vinland, and we're not absolutely sure to this day where it was.
Bjarni and his men return to Greenland and tell the other Norse settlers what they have seen.
And around the year 1000, Leif Erikson follows that same path from Greenland back to Vinland, becoming the first European to set foot in the Americas.
And the first encounter between the Norse and indigenous peoples in the Americas comes a few years later, when Leif's brother Torvald brings his own crew to Vinland.
When they arrive, the Vikings under Torvald come across 9 indigenous men sleeping, and then they do something horrible.
The Norse kill 8 of the 9 men, and then the 9th man escapes, and he comes back with some friends, and they then attack the Norse, and they shoot Torvald, and he dies of an arrow wound.
Torvald's men go back to Greenland, and several years after that, the Vikings return again to Vinland under the command of Thorfinn Karlsefni.
And this time, the Vikings not only make contact with the indigenous peoples, but they also trade goods with them. And this is the first recorded instance of Europeans trading with people in the Americas.
Here is where we have to say that we don't actually know just how true these stories are. But we do know that the stories are at least based on actual history. Valerie says that this trading network was one of the many trading networks that were being established simultaneously at that moment in history, around the year 1000.
To the west of the Atlantic Ocean, there were trading networks linking North and South America.
There is a trading center called Cahokia Mounds in East St. Louis. And at Cahokia, archaeologists have found goods from the Northeast, from the Great Lakes, from California. There's some evidence of ties to even the Maya.
And to the east of the Atlantic Ocean, Valerie says?
There are trade networks all through Europe. They're connected to Africa. There's a trade route from East Africa that goes up to Baghdad. And then that trade route goes around India and Southeast Asia and gets to China.
So by making it across the Atlantic and connecting east to west, the Vikings had closed the global loop, as Valerie says, when they established that trade with indigenous peoples in North America. And even if it wasn't a huge amount of trade, it was the first time in history that, hypothetically, an item that was traded almost anywhere in the world could have made it to almost any other part of the world. And that is how the Vikings launched globalization. or at least an early version of it.
Stacey Vanek Smith,
Cardiff Garcia, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Heifer International, working with the farmers who feed people as their rural communities continue to be affected by COVID-19. Information about the impact of donations is at heifer.org.
This is NPR News.
It's Morning Edition here on WPR. Classical music is coming up after the latest news in 10 minutes.
Support comes from the Racine Symphony, inviting you to join the symphony virtually via YouTube for a celebration of Polish cultural heritage Saturday, October 24th. Polish food and drink will be available for carryout from Ivanhoe Pub. More information is at racinesymphony.org.
The Postal Service has been in place for 200 years.
Make sure you're getting the full story. Listen to Morning Edition every weekday.
And thanks for listening to Morning Edition here on WPR. President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden will meet in their final scheduled presidential candidate debate tonight at 8. We'll bring you live NPR coverage hosted by Ari Shapiro. The debate will take place at Belmont University in Nashville, Tennessee. That's live NPR coverage tonight at 8 on Wisconsin Public Radio and online at WPR.org. A winter weather advisory is in effect until tomorrow morning for Bayfield, Ashland, and Iron counties. Today, fog and rain in the south, rain and snow for the rest of the state. 4 to 6 inches of accumulation is possible in the advisory area. Highs in the 30s for most of Wisconsin, but closer to 60 for the south. On Friday, cloudy with a chance of rain for south and central Wisconsin. Morning flurries, then sunny in the north, rain and snow for the northeast. Highs from the upper 30s to low 40s.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noel King.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Both of Georgia's U.S. Senate seats are up for grabs this year. In one race, election laws are forcing a three-way contest that includes two Republican candidates. The incumbent is welcoming support from a conspiracy theorist, a House candidate from North Georgia, who some call America's QAnon candidate. Lisa Hagan and Chris Haxel, co-hosts of NPR's investigative podcast No Compromise, have been watching her.
Marjorie Taylor Greene rolls up in her tan Humvee, big American flag flapping. United States Senator Kelly Loeffler's riding shotgun.
Hey, everybody.
Greene is a short, blonde, CrossFit-loving businesswoman who's running unopposed for Georgia's 14th congressional district. Loeffler is trying to survive her first Senate campaign. Georgia's governor appointed her to fill an open U.S. Senate seat. She started serving earlier this year. Georgia's Senate races are a little weird, and right now, Loeffler is running against both a Republican and a Democrat. That's meant Loeffler's current strategy is to present herself as the most pro-Trump conservative in the race.
And to do that, she sought out help from this very particular rising star in Georgia politics, Marjorie Taylor Greene.
They destroyed the NFL, they're destroying NASCAR, they're burning our cities and destroying our history.
She's a true newcomer to electoral politics. Greene has, however, built a large social media audience in conservative online spaces.
As part of our reporting on a growing, radical kind of American gun rights activism, we've watched Greene's rise from obscure live streamer to the doorstep of Congress. First time I met her was a year and a half ago. Spring of 2019.
I'm live right now. People are just watching.
It was at a tiny anti-abortion and pro-gun rally outside the Georgia State Capitol. A few dozen people gathered to listen to a well-known local militia figure. He threatened violence against abortion providers that day. At the time, I had no idea Greene, this chipper woman in aviator sunglasses, would be headed to Congress by 2021.
The key to her rise? Exactly what she was doing at that rally. Live streaming. A lot. often about her opposition to gun control, and also about elaborate claims of evil global plots.
I don't know how much you guys know about Q. It's an anonymous person. All right, so Q is a patriot.
How to explain QAnon. It is a constantly evolving tangle of conspiracy theories involving a satanic deep state pedophile ring.
You hear going down the rabbit hole. All right,
and so the deeper you go, the more anti-Semitic it gets.
Green's written about QAnon since its beginnings in 2017, made long, meandering videos about it.
There's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to take this global cable of Satan-worshipping pedophiles out. And I think we have the president to do it. And so
Green has tried to distance herself from these beliefs lately. And Senator Loeffler had her back when they appeared together last week.
No one in Georgia cares about this QAnon business. This is something that the fake news is going to continue to bring up and ignore Antifa and the violence promoted across this country.
It's a good strategy, according to Georgia political consultant Brian Robinson. He agrees Republican voters won't pay much attention to this conspiracy theory stuff.
They want to see somebody who's a warrior. They want to see somebody who's going to go and fight Pelosi and AOC and the squad. And that's what she's going to give them.
Robinson has seen Green's social media skills up close. He helped run a campaign for a Republican neurosurgeon who lost to Green in a primary. Robinson says actually making laws may not be all that relevant to her success. It's more about how well Green channels outrage.
Because the left, the Democrats, have become so radical. This is the party that cheers on riots and calls them peaceful protesters. This is the party that wants basically a revolution in our country because they want to radically transform America. And they want lawlessness because they want to defund the police.
This is language we've seen help mobilize a shift in the world of gun rights activism. Our investigation for NPR explores a growing movement of Second Amendment supporters who see the National Rifle Association as too weak on gun rights. Marjorie Taylor Greene is a rising champion of this movement.
In Georgia, she's maintained close ties to a state gun rights group run by a man named Patrick Parsons.
Rioting, looting, destruction, violence, all being pushed across the country by radical, left-wing, hate America socialists.
For months, he's campaigned loudly for Green in his pro-gun Facebook live streams.
Are you voting for Marjorie Taylor Greene, a friend of mine and a life member of Georgia gun owners out there in Paulding County? If you're not, you should think about it. Check her out.
Parsons has partnered with gun rights activists in other states to create a Facebook following of millions. This network of pro-gun websites has not only helped Green's rise to elected office, it may provide a guide for what to expect next. The no-compromise gun rights movement that Green is so closely tied to relies on a specific political model called confrontational politics. Developed in the 1970s, it's essentially a blueprint for leveraging small groups of dedicated supporters to seize power in state houses.
Social media, like Facebook live streams, have helped re-energize the confrontational politics model. So much so that we now see U.S. senators vying for the endorsement of characters like Green. As for the future House member herself, Brian Robinson doesn't think Green is likely to mellow when she gets to Congress in January.
I think the chances of her becoming a traditional legislator are, you know, somewhere close to the ballpark of zero. That's not going to happen.
He says he'll be watching for how Republican leadership reacts to Green's political style. For NPR, I'm Chris Haxel in Kansas City.
And I'm Lisa Hagan in Atlanta.
Lisa Hagan and Chris Haxel host the new NPR investigative podcast, No Compromise. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Noelle King.
And I'm Melissa Ingalls. Listen for Morning Edition weekdays from 5 to 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. News updates from NPR and WPR will be here every hour for you, as well as news on our website at WPR.org. And the latest news is up next, following that, classical music with Stephanie Elkins.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin-Madison, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
24/7 Jazz HD2 is available on your smartphone. For jazz, big band, and blues, go to the App Store and download the free WGTD app. HD2 is still available on your desktop at WGTD.org and in the Kenosha-Racine area on your HD radio.